Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, and it's the 13th of June, 2013. Today, we're joined by Douglas Valentine, a journalist, historian, author, and researcher who has written numerous books, including The Strength of the Wolf, The Secret History of America's War on Drugs, and The Phoenix Program, and many, many other books besides. All of those books can be found at douglasvalentine.com. So, Mr. Valentine, thank you very much for joining us today on the program.
You're very welcome. I hope I can bring some insights today.
I'm sure you'll be able to. So let's start. You've recently written a review of Jeremy Scahill's new documentary film, Dirty Wars. And this film has been enjoying almost universal acclaim in the progressive and the pseudo-alternative media sphere. But you have a very different take on this film and its shortcomings. Can you outline for us why this film falls short from your perspective?
Well, I got to view it about 2 days before it came out. The producers sent me a Vimeo, and I was a little bit hampered because of my poor hearing, and at times I had to call on my wife to help, because some of the statements were just so bizarre to me, and I wanted to double check. But I found this documentary, Dirty Wars, to be very thin on substance and long on style, heavy on style. Let me talk about the style first, because as anybody who's involved in the media or is a writer or a filmmaker knows, the way you can frame a message, the substance is also is involved with the style. And the style becomes very important in communicating to people the message that you want them to hear. So when I talk about the difference between style and substance, this is very important from a professional point of view. And the style is autobiographical in terms of Scahill telling the story from his point of view. He uses the personal pronouns I and me over and over and over again, and he establishes early on, him and his director and producers, that this is a story about him and his personal journey, which in terms of making a documentary film is quite a departure, because usually the people making a documentary film stay in the background and it's the subject of the documentary that takes precedence. But right away, it's established in this documentary that we're talking, that the focus is Jeremy Scahill. And the way that the filmmakers go about making this documentary reinforces this take on the story. It's very melodramatic. We're constantly reminded that Scahill's in grave personal danger, and the techniques that the filmmaker uses, innumerable close-ups of Jeremy Scahill, reinforce in every moment that this is a film about him. And so if you're a fan of Scahill's, this is very effective. And you're constantly, if you like him, you're drawn into his story. You're through the art of this documentary going to like it and believe what he says and forget about the substance, because it becomes like a theatrical production, something that Bigelow, Catherine Bigelow, would use. The lenses, the films, the photography uses filters, which are very artistic, but they reinforce this whole mood that the story is autobiographical and about Jeremy Scahill. So I found that very off-putting, and I didn't like it at all, because it's an important subject which needs to be understood for what it is and not through our hero, Jeremy Scahill. And now the substance is beyond thin. It's beyond thin, both in historical terms of describing what is a dirty war, and by which Scahill really means the war on terror. But historically, you have to understand that Dirty Wars applies initially in the 20 after World War II to the wars that colonial people were fighting for liberation against the colonialists. And the precepts for fighting a dirty war from their point of view are based on Mao Zedong's precepts for fighting a people's war. And this is a key word to understand in Dirty Wars, people versus colonialists. The people are badly outgunned. They're colonial people. They've been oppressed for generations. They have nothing. And in order to fight against their oppressors, they have to resort to guerrilla tactics. They use what in particular is called selective terrorism, which is going after other people who are collaborating with the government, with their oppressors. They go after in Algeria, the Algerian nationalists go after Algerians who are collaborating. In Vietnam, the Vietnamese revolutionaries go after Vietnamese who are collaborating. And they do all sorts of terrible things to these collaborators. They shoot them in the belly, they throw bombs into their cafes, they torture them, they string them up from lampposts because they hate them for collaborating, because they can't get at the colonialists themselves. And they do this for psychological purposes. The psychological purposes is, psychological warfare is at the root of dirty wars. It's why it's a dirty war. It pits brothers and families against each other, and it's done so that the nationalists can get some publicity and they can prove to the other people that they can fight against the colonialists, that they're not impotent, that they can make a statement, and that and it gets across their revolutionary message. This is what dirty wars is, because the colonialists, and this includes the United States, develop means of fighting the people which are even more vicious. And the idea is to show that if you, a revolutionary, want to go after one of our collaborators, then not only are we going to kill you and torture you, we're going to torture you and your family and your friends. So this is what is happening in Afghanistan. This is what's happening in Pakistan. It's what's happening in Somalia. It's happening all around the world. It's the essence of what a dirty war is. And Scahill never even touches on this. He doesn't even give us a clue that it's not about him. It's about the Afghans. It's about the Pakistanis. It's about the Somalis. And the only way that we begin to see these people in Scahill's documentary is as props for his story about himself. And the other substantive deficiency in this movie is organizational. How the United States organizes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, it's war on terror. All we ever know is that there's some evil villain named General McRaven who lurks in the background, and nobody knows who he is because he's covert. And in fact, we know everything about how these people organize and how the policy comes out of the National Security Council with the support of Congress and the majority of the American people who are all for this, and that how the policies directives go to the CIA station in these countries and the military command, and how the State Department organizes all this together, and all of this is just there's no mention of any of this at all. So we don't really understand what the United States is doing in these countries. All we know is very deceptively that Jeremy Scahill is a super sleuth who's going to uncover who's going to investigate a murder and tell us how he solved it. So I just found I was just repulsed by this documentary, and that is why.
Well, let's explore that historical dirty war context that's excluded from this. As I mentioned in the introduction, you've written an entire book on the Phoenix program, which is part of that historical context which Scahill fails to provide in the film. For the viewers out there who don't know about Operation Phoenix, the Phoenix program, please tell us about what this program was and why it is important to the story.
Well, it's not only important to the story, it's important to understanding the war on terror. And its Phoenix program, before I tell you about the background, is a model for how the CIA, with the help of military special forces, fights the war on terror. And if you understand the Phoenix program and its development, then you'll understand everything I said to you earlier about the history and the organization. And so Phoenix becomes the keyhole and through which you can understand this. Phoenix was a program that the CIA developed in Vietnam in 1967, but it was based on, it came into fruition based on the CIA's experience in Vietnam from the time it got there after World War II. In 1954, which is when the Phoenix program begins to be developed, the CIA moved into Vietnam along with the United States government as its colony. It had taken over Vietnam from the French, which were defeated at Dien Bien Phu. But the United States did not want to see Vietnam fall to the communists, who were essentially the nationalist force for organizing the people against the French. So the United States, through the CIA, went into relationships with the government, the South Vietnamese government, which it created. Just as it created Karzai in Afghanistan. And so the parallels are significant in that respect as well. The CIA is basically the branch of the government that creates these puppet rulers, and it keeps them in power through creating what's called a political order of battle. The CIA goes into relationship in a country that it wants to colonize, and through a puppet ruler like Diem in South Vietnam, through relationship with the police special branches in that country. And it advises these police special branches, which are like the FBI. And it creates lists of anybody political who's organizing against the puppet ruler. And it provides tear gas and guns and equipment and technology to help these police forces to root out and find anybody who's subversive and operating politically against the government that it's propping up. And they're very vicious in the way they go about this. They create all the things that we've heard about recently: renditions, secret interrogation centers, mercenary forces that go out in the middle of the night and kidnap people and torture them and kill their families. All this stuff is going on starting in 1954. This is how the CIA combats a dirty war, which was what was happening in Vietnam. Well, in 1965, the United States, all this is going on for 10 years, and then in 64 and 65, the United States decides it actually has to combat the North Vietnamese forces militarily. And the United States military goes into Vietnam, and its purpose is to create battles. The military wants to create battles, and it wants to fight the North Vietnamese main forces and in a traditional World War II manner win the war. Rah, 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 the United States has the firepower to do this. But by 1967, and military intelligence is only interested in learning the size and location of the enemy forces so it can battle them and start a fight with them. But by 67, it becomes evident that there's actually a national movement. The Viet Cong and the shadow government are winning the war for the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people. And no matter how much you fight a conventional war, politically, the people are still on the side of the insurgents. And so in 1967, based on its political order of battle, the CIA creates the Phoenix Program. And the Phoenix Program is going to combine military intelligence and political intelligence in order to wipe out the political infrastructure, the shadow government, which is civilians, by the way. These are not soldiers. These are like, if you were going to have a Phoenix Program in the Civil War, it would be killing the mayor of Macon, Georgia, assassinating Jefferson Davis. They're going after the people who are in the unions, organizing against the government, the people, school teachers, anybody in any the CIA has been keeping lists on all these people for 10 years. They know everybody. They have it now. It's computerized. They're going to wipe them all out. They're going to kill them all. They're going to put them in prison. They're going to turn them into double agents. And that's what the Phoenix Program is. And the military very reluctantly contributes its, not just its special forces, but its regular military intelligence units. And the CIA runs this thing. And this is important to understand. It's the CIA that runs these political wars, the political wiping out civilians who are politically against their puppet rulers. This is what the CIA does. But it puts the military out front because the CIA is a covert organization, and you can't go around saying they're always off the organizational chart. So Phoenix becomes associated with the military, and it's called a military program, but it's always the CIA that runs it. And this is still the formula that is used today. The CIA and the government put the military out front. They say this is a military operation, but it's really a political operation run by the CIA against civilians. And that's why it's important to understand and really in depth how these things work, because it's a lot of it's a shell game, and there's a lot of covers that are put up in front by Congress, by the State Department to hide the hand of the CIA, which is assassinating civilians.
Well, as you point out, this is a CIA template. It's been implemented by the CIA time and time again in the past, and we see the same things being implemented right now in the War on Terror. But in your review of Dirty Wars, you point out that the CIA is only ever mentioned once or twice in the entire film. Given the central role of the agency in this Dirty War history, what does this tell us about Scahill's research, or at least his honesty about that research?
Well, you know, in terms of, and I'm going to answer your question, but and I don't want to seem evasive. But you have to ask Scahill that question. And you have to, you know, because I don't know why he only mentioned the CIA once or maybe twice in this entire Dirty Wars documentary, given the fact that the CIA is the driving force in Dirty Wars. You have to ask him. You have to ask Crowley, his director or producer. You'd have to ask Amy Goodman and the people at The Nation who are bankrolling Scahill and who certainly reviewed this film from top to bottom and signed off on it. These are the people, the editors and the producers and Scahill himself, who are responsible for this. And I have a funny feeling that Goodman and Rowley and The Nation are quite willing to push Scahill out front. It's part of this artistry of having it about him. And it's another purpose that this artistry of making it autobiographical about Scahill serves is it keeps this narrow focus on him and not on the people behind this film and their motives and intentions for covering up the role of the CIA. So an investigation of this can't focus on Scahill. He's symptomatic. He's the epitome but it's also not the driving force. Not mentioning the CIA, there's two explanations, and neither one of them is a very happy explanation. One is that he's stupid. I don't know what the CIA is, and he just doesn't know, you know. And given who I think Scahill is, you know, and he's a very superficial character. Everything he's written is very superficial. It appears to have been derived from the internet. I don't think he's ever read really any books. I don't think he has any background, so I think that his own ignorance plays into this. And it's kind of a happy ignorance. Ignorance being bliss, but I think that it's a factor in it. The other explanation is that they're being dishonest, Scahill and his producers and backers, and that they know that the CIA is there, and that they have reasons for not talking about it, that they're not telling us. I can't get into that because I don't know. And if I speculate about it, it seems to cast a kind of aspersion upon him, which is baseless without knowing the facts. So at some point, somebody has to ask him and those people what their reasons are so that we can establish that and then begin to analyze why they did this. But I don't know. But I will say it's part of the film. It's part of the documentary. It's interwoven into it, and it becomes apparent about 25 or 30 minutes into the documentary, which I will, when he makes the statement that he had never heard of the Joint Special Operations Command until he heard about this murders in Gardez. I actually had a struggle to get this review out in time because I only got it the day before I put it up at Counterpunch, which has a weekend edition on Friday, and I had to get my wife, wait for her to come home from work on Thursday night and have her actually listen to this and confirm to me that he said he had never heard about JSOC until February 10th, 2010, when this Gardez massacre was brought to his attention. And he actually says this twice in the documentary, that he had never heard of it until this moment, which, as I said in my review, is like a botanist saying he'd never heard of flowers. If you're a national security correspondent, this is something that you absolutely know about. It was revealed in 1988 by Steve Emerson in his book Secret Warriors that this organization was created. And December 1980, I remember talking about it with people in 87 and 88. For a national security correspondent not to know about JSOC is mind-boggling. And somebody yesterday who read the review sent me an excerpt from his book, which is also called Dirty Wars, which I haven't read. But in the excerpt, he talks about knowing about JSOC at the end of 2009. So maybe it is part of the artistry of this film for him to say it, because it adds to the melodrama. You know, it reinforces the notion that JSOC is, you know, this secret force that he's going to have to uncover and reveal to us for the first time. So it may be a part of the artistry of this documentary, which is actually very theatrical, and the fact that it occurs 25 minutes into the movie is typically when, according to standard movie scripts, you have your first plot twist. This is how a guy who writes a movie script. There's a plot twist 30 minutes in, a second plot twist 60 minutes in, and then a surprise ending. This is standard Hollywood format for how you construct a theatrical production. It is not a standard format for how you do a documentary. And so this was the turning point in this documentary film for me, when he makes this revelation about JSOC. And of course, he never discovers the hand in the CIA in any of this, which added to my shock and awe.
Good choice of terms. Well, I think you've answered some of this in what you just said, but let's talk a little bit about the celebrity of Jeremy Scahill. He's sort of becoming this celebrity in his own right, and he's being promoted by Democracy Now! And promoted by the nation. And I don't know if you saw, he was just on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. So he is certainly making the media rounds and becoming a media celebrity. What can you say about Scahill's celebritization and what that indicates about what is really behind this documentary?
Well, I've thought a lot about this over the years. And of course, it's, like I said, he's symptomatic. He's an epitome. He's not by any means the cause of this phenomena that we're seeing, the celebrity culture that we live in. But we do live in a celebrity culture. So when you want to appeal to the masses, you have to come at them in the way that they want to be approached. And you can root for, I'm going to get into this seriously, but you can root for the Patriots, or you can root for the Denver Broncos. You can hate the guys on the Broncos, or you can hate the guys on the Patriots, but everybody likes the swimsuit part of Sports Illustrated, that's Jeremy Scahill's role. He's sexy. He's the poster boy for an industry. He's a good-looking guy. He's glib. He's willing to go along with the self-promotion. He's willing to promote himself. The technology that's available today enables this. He's on Facebook. He's on Twitter. He tweets. Jeremy, Scahill tweets. And in his ignorance of the larger revolutionary picture that's going on, is quite willing to be the poster boy. But it's the industry behind him, this industry of the nation and Democracy Now!, which is a cottage industry, which is making a lot of money and wielding a lot of political influence through Scahill in his celebrity, because you could see them as either riding on his coattails, or you could see them as using him to make money and to spread their political influence as technology enables them to reach a much wider audience than they could when they weren't allowed to be on TV. And, obviously the major networks are on TV, CBS, NBC. You can watch Fox, or you can watch MSNBC. And you can choose which ideology, which political brand you want. You can choose Coke, or you can use Pepsi. This Anvil chorus, which has completely stifled debate in America between the Republican right and the Democratic left, and is what I refer to as the Anvil Chorus, has completely stymied any honest evaluation of what goes on. You can read about why this exists in Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent. And when he did this book, Manufacturing Consent, and he talked about the lack of self-censorship and the inability to challenge assumptions. He was basically at the time talking about government propaganda. But now these same principles can be applied across the board. And it's no longer just applying these principles to the right and the government. These same principles, ironically, because Chomsky's off and on Democracy Now have to be applied to what's going on with Democracy Now in the nation. But the left is absolutely incapable of any kind of critical self-analysis in these terms. They think that propaganda, psychological warfare, media bias and censorship are purely a province of the right. But they're equally a province of the left for the same exact purpose. You can, and this is no, I'm not disparaging Beck or Greenwald, but you can listen to Glenn Beck or you can listen to Glenn Greenwald, but it's still Glenn. And Beck tells his people what they want to hear and they love it. And Greenwald tells his people what they want to hear and they love it. But they never actually criticize themselves or look inward to challenge the people that they identify with. And this is what people like Goodman and the nation thrive on. And what's enables their little cottage industries to exist. And it would be giving Scahill much more credit than he deserves to factor him into this equation. The social and cultural forces that are behind this and which are manipulated by the power elites on both sides totally eclipse his personality. Although he's blithely happy, like any celebrity, you know, to go along because he's making out like a bandit and he's a guy on the make. But you have to totally disassociate him from the forces that are behind him and manipulating him. And there's always going to be this lack of a synthesis in the United States. There's the thesis and there's the antithesis, but the establishment loves this anvil course between the right and the left because it precludes there ever becoming a synthesis of people on the right and people on the left getting together and actually becoming rational and having any united engaging in any kind of united effort against the establishment. And it's how the media and the establishment controls us. And Scahill is, and this why the left won't criticize him is the epitome, an example of what's going on in this cultural, political, economic phenomena that we're seeing.
Well, that's right. If you can manufacture consent, then you can manufacture dissent, maybe. Well, it's an incredibly important topic, and if there's anything good to come out of this movie, maybe it's the fact that now people will at least be interested in the real history of the Dirty Wars. So for people who are interested in this, are there any other thoughts you'd like to share with the viewers or places you'd like to direct them for more information they can find about the excluded history of the Dirty Wars?
Well, it's all out there. There's a ton of stuff. Believe me, it's all out there. All you have to do is go to the library and start reading Franz Fanon, who I talk about, Ratchet of the Earth. There's just hundreds of books read Phil Agee, read John Stockwell, people, guys who were whistleblowers, who actually served in the CIA, who describe all this stuff in painstaking detail. It still applies today. They wrote this stuff 40 years ago during the height of the Vietnam War when people were interested because 50,000 Americans have been killed. We've progressed beyond that point. The United States national security state is not going to do that anymore. They're not going to draft Americans by the thousands, hundreds of thousands, by the millions, and allow Vietnam to happen again. But back then, we learned everything about Dirty War that we need to learn. Which then you need to overcome any personal bias you have against military people or CIA people. You need to read military journals. You need to read what the right in the national security state is saying. Stephen Aftergood does a very good website called Secrecy Report or something. I can't remember. I subscribe to it, but for the life of me, I can't remember right now. Read the Congressional Research Service's reports on the military, on the CIA. They tell you exactly what's going on. They're there. You don't need to get opinions about these things from opinion makers like Greenwald and Scahill. You can go right to the source. There's a million sources. They're all there. And read for yourself what's actually happening and then come to your own opinions. Make your own opinions and not rely on other people to tell you what their opinions are, so you don't have to think about this stuff, but you got to do the work. And unfortunately, most of us can't, and we got to rely on people for opinions. But if you have the time, just go direct to the direct sources. And if you can, get organizational charts, see how these organizations are constructed, and learn what they actually do. And again, all the information's out there. Just, you got to look for it.
Well, that's it. There's no excuse for ignorance in this age when all of this information really is at our fingertips. Just for the record, that's Stephen Aftergood's Secrecy News at the Federation of American Scientists.
I get that every day, and it's just fabulous. And he's right down the middle. He's not left. He's not right. Whatever his opinions are, I don't know. It's just straightforward news, and which is so rare, because you don't get straightforward news on MSNBC, you don't get straightforward news on Fox, you certainly don't get it at Democracy Now! Or The Nation. It's all just spin, and people have to be rational and be able to disassociate themselves from their own prejudices and biases.
All right, a fascinating conversation. So once again, I hope people will check out your website. That's douglasvalentine.com. I will put the link in the show notes for the interview. So Douglas Valentine, thank you very much for your time today.
You're very welcome.